It's 12 o'clock. It's Monday. It's KZSU Stanford, and it's time again for another edition of the Lunch Special. Welcome to another edition of the Lunch Special here at KZSU. And today, this is extremely honoring. I'm joined by consulting professor in the statistics department, but he also has so many different titles that I can't even, if I started it now, well, I wouldn't get over before 1 o'clock. So, consulting professor David Stork of the Stanford University Statistics Department is here. David, welcome to KZSU.
Thanks, Bert. It's really a great pleasure to be here.
And have you ever been on the on KZSU before?
Not KZSU. Lots of other radio stations.
I was gonna say talking off mic, we found out so much about you that I had to get a second sheet of paper on you. Who was that we just heard?
That was John Adams. He's a composer in Berkeley, California, and he's done a lot of wonderful pieces. This was Short Ride in a Fast Machine. It's only 4 minutes, 13 seconds, and it's one of the most energetic, powerful evocations of speed, I think, in the orchestral literature. I played it once several years ago with the Redwood Symphony Orchestra right up here in Redwood City, playing claves. I'm a percussionist, and claves are just the wooden sticks that go tap, tap, tap all the way throughout it, and it's incredibly fun to play. Lots of cross rhythms and things like that.
I could tell that you had played that piece once because you did the air guitar routine in here in the studio with the claves, the entire routine of the thing, which is very enjoyable for all of us.
Air percussion, yes.
Yeah, there you go, air percussion. But you have many different hats, and I don't even want to get into it now. We want to play this great music you've brought. Is there a theme to the music today?
No, I think absolutely none.
Good. And this next song will prove it, and you want to go ahead and set this up?
Oh, it's...
Crosby, Stills, Nash & Young's right?
Woodstock, the their version of the Joni Mitchell song.
You're not that old.
I was not there, I assure you.
Why did you pick this tune?
I wanted it different from orchestral music, just to show some range. And I think this sort of summarizes the 60s pretty well for those students who, all of them, who were born well after that.
Right. Let's check it out here. Crosby, Stills, Nash, and Young. Maybe Neil's listening up on the hill. The song about the show Woodstock with Crosby, Stills, Nash, and Young. And I'm here today with my guest, consulting professor David Stork, who's also kind of on loan today from his day job at RICO over just a few blocks away, right, David?
Yep, on Sand Hill Road.
So you do 9 to 5 over there, and then you also teach here at Stanford and then all the other things, too?
Part-time, yeah.
Damn, dude.
Every weekend.
And you got a family, too. Do you get to see them very
well,
often?
Luckily. I mean, my son's off at UC Santa Barbara.
All right.
And just my daughter is here in high school, Woodside High.
Oh, very cool. We got the explanation on Woodstock and Crosby, Stills, Nash and Young. What's got that? Now, next is we got a classical piece coming up. This is going to be interesting.
Yeah, this is Durfle's Requiem, and I think this is one of the most beautiful, quiet, angelic pieces for choir and orchestra ever written. And it's part of his Requiem, Opus 9. It's in Paradisum, about what it's like when you get to heaven. So listen in.
Heaven. You know, I was just about ready to fall asleep on that last one, man. What is that music to fall asleep by? What do they call that?
To ascend to, in Paradisum.
I see. So we're here with a consulting professor, because he has so many different titles and jobs, that that's all you can do here at Stanford. Not all you can do. You can do a whole lot, but you're kind of a part-time professor, right?
That's right.
And David Stork, our guest for the hour, bringing in some very interesting music. And next up, you got this is you took a left turn on us.
I suppose
you did this on purpose too. And I think it's going to be a great little surprise. You want to set it up?
No, let's just listen to it.
Okay, here it is. Thank you. afternoon jazz for your listening pleasure here on the Lunch Special on KZSU. Here with consulting professor in statistics, David Stork. David, you're a jazz fan too.
Oh, somewhat. I'm not that knowledgeable, but this Giant Steps by John Coltrane has always captured my admiration and interest. It's, you can listen to it 100 times and it never...
Always hear something new.
Yeah.
And besides being a music enthusiast, you're a musician.
Yeah.
You're a scientist. You work at RICO.
Mm-hmm. RICO Innovations.
RICO Innovations. You consult in, you do some professoring around here. And I've read this and I want to say it. You're the world leading expert in computer image analysis of art.
I suppose.
And is this a large part of your work? Because I also want to mention that in the last 6 weeks, well, having built up 2 million frequent flyer miles, in the last 6 weeks you visited...
Not in the last... total is 2 million frequent flyer
miles.
Okay, all
right.
Not just in the last 6 weeks.
Oh, not the last 6 weeks.
I don't
weeks.
Think
okay.
even professional
so you have 2
that.
Million frequent flyer miles.
Yeah.
In the last 6 weeks you've been to the Netherlands, Germany, Austria, Taiwan, Kyoto, and Tokyo, and you're on your way
to Italy.
Okay, I didn't want to miss that. You're on your way to Purdue University, Montreal, Ottawa, New York, Singapore, and 2 days in Bali.
That's right.
No wonder you got so many frequent flyer miles.
That's the point.
Are these all stops you're lecturing at?
Yeah. Usually conferences or universities want to hear about my work, mainly on computer image analysis of art, but also my more day job-y work on designing optical systems that design the optics and the image processing together for new kinds of imaging systems, new kind of cameras, endoscopes, stuff like that.
Okay. Now let's start at the start. Where'd you grow up?
I was born in Bryn Mawr, Pennsylvania, outside Philadelphia, and grew up in Chevy Chase outside Washington, D.C.
Were your parents academics?
No, my grandfather was. He got his PhD from the University of Pennsylvania and was on the faculty there and was on the faculty in Germany and several other places. My father was a writer, but it was really my grandfather who was the academician.
Mm-hmm. You said your father was a writer. You mean an author of books?
No, mainly things for the government. The government writes lots of stuff, and so he was in Washington doing a lot of
You're
work.
Talking like in the 40s during the war?
No, well, after that. Gosh. I mean,
50s, 60s?
He worked till 85, I guess it was, something like that.
Wow.
Yeah.
And... Where'd you do your regular college?
Yeah, I went to MIT, got a degree in physics from MIT, and then the University of Maryland, got my PhD in College Park.
And what did you get your PhD in physics as well?
Physics. All my degrees are in physics, mm-hmm. but I've had faculty positions in 8 programs or disciplines. Here they are, if you need to know them. Physics, mathematics, electrical engineering, neuroscience, psychology, statistics, computer science, and art history.
I mean, you've taught in all those subjects in different universities around the
Actually,
country?
Actually, the only one where I haven't taught is in mathematics. I was a visiting professor of mathematics at Boston University for 2 years, and I actually didn't teach there. I just did research.
Man, you've done a lot of roaming around.
I guess.
Now, besides all that... Yeah, that wasn't enough. You're a musician. You play timpani and percussion.
Yeah.
And you've played with a very wide range of musicians, including Pavarotti and the Smothers Brothers.
That's the wide range, yes. There's a lot of people in between.
What's up with that, man?
Well, let's see. In Massachusetts, before I came out here to California, I was in the Worcester Orchestra, the Central Massachusetts Symphony, and the Worcester Bach Society Orchestra, and a lot of pickup orchestras. And one of those had Pavarotti give a New Year's Eve concert, so I accompanied him there.
Did you learn that as a kid? Were you classically trained?
Yeah. My father had a master's degree in music, my mother a bachelor's degree in fine arts piano, and so our whole family is very musical.
Oh, okay, so it came from childhood.
Yeah.
Your love of music.
Yeah.
And then you got into the academia side of it, completely blew it up, got your PhD. How old were you when you got your PhD?
Gosh, I forget.
Twenties?
End of my 20s. The thing is, I took off some time. I taught my first full college course when I was 24. I taught at Wellesley College.
Isn't that kind of young?
Yeah. No, in fact...
Especially for back then, too, right?
And an all-women's school. Right. In fact, I'd studied art history at Wellesley, and one of the students who was in my class, I was a senior when she was a freshman, later I came back and taught there, she was now one of my students.
So, now, did you just say that was all girls college?
Women's college, yeah.
But you said you studied there?
You cross-registered from MIT, yeah.
They allowed that, even though it was all women's college?
They allowed it.
So apparently it wasn't an all women's college.
That's one way.
People could transfer in?
The only ones who can get a degree are women.
Oh, okay. That's how that works.
Yeah.
And of all these things, now you're an author as well. I don't want to miss anything here. You're an author as well. 6 books, and you got another one coming out soon?
Yeah. This next one is conference proceedings volume with Jim Coddington of the Museum of Modern Art and Anna Benkowska-Koffel of the Courtauld Institute in London, called, I think it's Computer Image Analysis and the Study of Art, something like that, or Computer Vision and Image Analysis of Art.
Mm-hmm.
And that'll come out.
And I want to get into that too, but
sure.
HAL 9000, what's that?
Well, if anyone's been driving around Palo Alto, Menlo Park, Portola Valley, Woodside, and seen a license plate that says HAL 9000, well, that would be my car. I have the license plate, HAL 9000. I saw the movie 2001, A Space Odyssey, when I was a kid, and just was completely awed and inspired by that film. And so, many years later, as a practicing scientist, I put together a book called HAL's Legacy, 2001's Computer as Dream and Reality, comparing what the movie, in some sense, predicted would be happening in computer science in the year 2001 with what actually did happen. And then we got money from the Alfred P. Sloan Foundation, and David Kennard up in Marin County and I made a PBS television documentary called 2001 HAL's Legacy, where we went all around the world filming major research labs on topics that appear in the film, like Garry Kasparov playing chess against IBM's Deep Blue. Of course, there's a scene in the movie 2001 where Dave plays HAL in chess. And things like speech recognition and lip reading. I used to work on computer lip reading and graphics and so forth. So I know a lot about the movie 2001, A Space Odyssey. I've seen it 43 times or
so.
What
did you find out? What was your
conclusions? Oh, there's so much.
Did Hollywood stretch it out farther than real life? Or
yes.
Was real life bigger than Hollywood?
There are only about 4 areas where they, in some sense, got it right. Things like computer reliability. We can make computers as reliable as HAL if we had to when it's really important. And things like computer graphics. Actually, computer graphics is one area where computer science has surpassed the image in 2001 because they didn't have advanced computer graphics back in 1968, so they couldn't do the kinds of stuff that any one of the Stanford students can do with Photoshop and stuff like this.
So even the wild imagination couldn't go as far as computers have gone.
It was partly that, and partly just would have been really hard to make. The kind of realistic computer graphics we make now, it took millions and millions of lines of code and millions and millions of hours, or many, many hours, to code up, and it would have been really hard to get that through. But on the areas that really captured the public's imagination, which center around the field of artificial intelligence, which is one of the areas I work in, making HAL smart and understand language and really see, we are far, far short. These are some of the most difficult problems in all of science, and the public doesn't understand that, unfortunately, how hard it is to make a computer see or understand language. Anyway, the movie was very, in some sense, optimistic compared to reality.
Kind of cool for us because I remember what HAL did.
Absolutely.
And we don't need that, do we?
We don't, but part of the sort of philosophical underpinnings of the movie are, if we give something intelligence, do we give it, quote, free will? Does it have the creativity to do things that we cannot anticipate? And surely there are many things that computers will do as they get more complex that we can't anticipate, whether it's protect itself and kill 4 of the 5 crewmen. We hope we can avoid, but lots of science fiction is predicated on sinister stuff indeed.
Now, are you a fan of the Terminator movies?
Oh, not particularly.
Did you see them?
Oh, I've seen them all, sure.
Okay, even the latest one that came out
months ago? Not the most recent one.
But you did see the last one put out?
Yeah, yeah.
How far off are we from that?
Oh, I think we're far off.
We are?
Yeah. I mean, the simplest things that we take for granted, looking at my hand here and recognizing it as a hand or recognizing a face and its emotions and the subtleties in speech and language and scene analysis, being able to describe this room. I can do it effortlessly. And we are so, so, so very far from getting a computer that can just look in this room and say, oh, well, there's a clock over here and there are two lights there and look at these monitors. And so, that's incredibly complex. As I say, unfortunately, most, you know, the person on the street doesn't realize how profound these problems are because they do them effortlessly. I mean, I fly a lot, as you mentioned.
2 million miles.
And, you know, I'm often sitting next to someone and, oh, what do you do? Oh, I'm a corporation president. What do you do? Oh, I work on pattern recognition. What's that? And I try to explain it. Things like, oh, you know, how do you recognize that this is a glass of, you know, Chardonnay in front of you? Oh, well, you just, obviously, you just look at it. And they don't realize the incredible amount of computation and the subtleties that go on for us to be able to do this effortlessly.
The human brain really is a magic computer, isn't it?
It's far beyond what we've got right now.
It is amazing. Now, it seems that your chief work, and our guest today is consulting professor David Stork, the world's leading expert in computer imaging analysis of art. And that seems to be probably some of your biggest work, huh? That's where you go a lot of your lectures and stuff?
It's what has captured the public's imagination, I think. And for the first few years, I would say the art community looked at it askance, that, oh, what can science tell us about art, you know, anything of interest. And then about, I would say, 3 years ago, I finally... I think it was really them. I was giving the same talks, and the right people came through. And a few professors of art history came to my talk and said, oh, my God, this is unbelievable. This is going to change everything.
What did it change?
In particular, these were art historians who subscribed to the older view of connoisseurship, the highly educated, trained eye, looking very carefully at an artwork. There are many other sort of branches of art history where you're interested in the politics and feminism and Marxism and things like this, where the close viewing, the close visual analysis of a work is not as important. But for those where, you know, very close looking is really important, my techniques and those of some of my colleagues are really expanding what we can see in paintings. For instance, I worked with Kimo Johnson, now at MIT, and a few others, on lighting analysis in works of Vermeer. So you're probably familiar with Girl with a Pearl Earring, a very famous painting in the Mauritshuis in The Hague. And we looked at six different ways of... let me back up and say, all the art historians say, oh, look how subtly and wonderfully he renders the effects of light. Well, you can behold this painting and be impressed, but what Kimo and I and others did was use computer vision techniques to analyze the lighting in ways far more subtle than any human eye can do, I think.
What did you find out?
Well, for instance, we looked at the glints off her eyeballs and the glints off her pearl and the subtle pattern of lighting around the outside boundary of her face. And we looked at the cast shadow and we made full computer graphics models of her face, each one to estimate the direction of light in that painting. And it turns out all of them agree to about 3 or 4 angular degrees. This is a remarkable achievement that they all agree so well.
A real tribute to the painter.
A real tribute to the painter, and it answers several questions. For instance, this is not a portrait. We don't know who this girl was. It's a so-called trony, which is a kind of painting to celebrate, in this case, youth and beauty and so forth. And some art historians wondered whether she was just in Vermeer's imagination, whether he painted this whole thing sort of from his imagination.
Kind of like computer graphics?
Sort of, I guess. Or whether there was really a girl. And the fact that all these clues agree so well almost surely shows that there really was a girl present. Now, that's not a major discovery in art history, but there are other things that art historians are interested in that work about. For instance, imagine 5 of those clues agreed really well, but that the glint off her pearl differed by, I don't know, 10 degrees. Well, that would suggest that the pearl was added later, or maybe as an afterthought. And this happens all the time, especially in Renaissance art. So someone would have a commission a portrait, bring it home and say, you know, I want my wife to have a pearl, and commission someone else to add the pearl.
Really?
It happens all the time.
Wow.
Or different figures within a given painting done by different artists, different mm-hmm. hands, as we could say. And the fact that that's not the case for the Vermeer, A Girl with a Pearl Earring, almost mm-hmm. surely shows that it was done entirely by Vermeer. Again, not a major breakthrough, but now art historians are very interested in using these techniques for studying other works.
Now, in your work, it sounds like you've blown some minds, the older minds of you know, the old art experts. Has anything controversial come down the pike where you know, you've discovered something and they all thought, you know, it flipped the script on?
Well, I don't want to get into it here. There was a theory about, 9 years ago that early Renaissance painters like Robert Campan and Jan van Eyck secretly built concave mirror projectors to project images onto their canvas that they would trace. And I was the first scientist invited to comment on that theory, and I've published a number of papers on it and lectured very widely on it. And now it's quite clear. I mean, there are 25, I think, at last count, scholarly articles, or 25 scholars in science, computer vision, art history, history of optics and science, and so forth, that all show that that did not happen, at least not that early, not mm-hmm. way back in 1430. Much, much later, we know some artists did this. Thomas Aikens, the great American master, secretly took black and white photographs of his subjects and would project them onto his canvas, trace them, and then fill in paint. But this was...
Really?
Yeah, and he denied it in his lifetime.
How did that get found out?
Well, the first indication was by Edward Hopper, the very famous painter who suggested that...
Maybe he was tracing.
But this was a time when the role of photography was very controversial. And, you know, the role of art versus fine art and painting versus photography was very controversial. And Aikens denied it in his lifetime. But there are very clear evidence of tracings in the X-rays of the underpainting, the work underneath. And about, 10 or 12 years ago, curators at the Philadelphia Museum of Art came across a trove of black and white photographic plates by Aikens' hands that matched the paintings too closely. I mean, wow. you overlap them and they overlap. So we know it happened much, much later, but whether it occurred in 1430, I think the scholarly consensus is definitely not. Anyway, so that's one of the, so that was a controversy. I think it's completely over now.
So this work could go on forever because the art world is just, I mean, you know.
Oh, there's so much art to work on. I mean, right. I'm working right now on authenticating Jackson Pollock's paintings, you know, the famous Jack the Dripper,
uh-huh.
the action painter.
They're having you go over his paintings to make sure that they're real? Or are these people that have bought some of his paintings and they want to make sure they're real?
I would claim, and most serious people would claim, the computer techniques we're developing are not yet ready for the tens of million dollar decisions that art buyers.
You don't want to have that responsibility,
and it's just not. It's premature. Nevertheless, a number of us. The ball got started by Richard Taylor at the University of Oregon, who suggested that Pollock's paintings had some sort of fractal structure in it, which means that if you look at it at different scales, different sizes, the same kinds of patterns would repeat at smaller and smaller and smaller scales. And I won't go through the math, but there are mathematical ways to describe that. And he reported that genuine Pollocks had a particular kind of structure and fake Pollocks did not. Well, that sort of got the ball started, but this is an instance of what's called, we in pattern recognition call, texture recognition. How do you tell the difference between the visual texture of my corduroy pants or those wood, you know, the wood wall or sand on the beach or so? You're not recognizing an object, you're recognizing a texture.
Mm-hmm.
And what's well known in pattern recognition is that you need many features. You look at, you know, the amount of vertical lines, amount of horizontal lines, the overall lightness, and whole range if you're ever going to do it. Any recognition that's recognizer that works on just a single one is frankly doomed to failure. One number cannot describe the difference between a single, a genuine Pollock and a fake Pollock. So I and Mohammed Irfan at Stony Brook University were the first to use multiple features for recognizing, for distinguishing genuine Pollocks from fake Pollocks. And what we showed was that indeed you can do better than chance. It's not 100% correct. Nothing's going to be 100% correct in the world of art. Even the best connoisseurs are not 100% correct, but it is better than chance. And so any extra information that comes through these kinds of things can be useful in authentication. We haven't authenticated anything for, a commercial gallery yet or anything like that, but we're working on this. We have another paper coming out in January on just this topic. So that's the kind of stuff I do.
You're listening to consulting professor here at Stanford, David Stork, the leading expert, the world's leading expert in computer image analysis of art, also a author of 6 books, a PhD from the University of Maryland, played with Pavarotti and the Smothers Brothers, taught on 8 different universities and 8 different subjects, has a license plate called HAL 9000 in case you want to run him down and
don't
talk
run
to
me
him.
Down. In fact, just 2 weeks ago, somebody tailed me. I was just going to the drugstore to buy, shaving cream or something, and a guy stopped right next to me and said, "I've been following you for miles." And I thought, "Uh-oh, who knows?" And he said, "That's the best license plate I've ever seen." And so
wow.
He shook my hand and we talked about HAL for 10 minutes. Anyway, so don't run me down, folks, please.
Yeah, don't do that. You can email him. We'll give you the email later on in the show. We do have some more music ready to go. And I think you're going to do the Bach, right?
Oh, yes. Yes, we are.
Why don't you talk about that a little bit?
Oh, well, this is Glenn Gould. What to say about Glenn Gould?
Say something about Glenn Gould.
The Canadian pianist is by far my favorite interpreter of Bach. I've read, 8 books on him. He was a recluse. He famously shunned the concert stage, I think at age 32 or something like this. He said he would never go on stage again, and so he devoted his life to recording piano music, including Bach and many others, Webern and others. The interpretation is just so clean and crisp, and one scholar, critic said, it's like listening to an x-ray of Bach's music. You just see all the essentials, and every line is brought out separately. And so what I brought in today, I have one full CD, but we'll listen to part of Suite 5 and part of Suite 6 from Bach's French Suites.
Here it is. Thank you. If there was ever speed piano, that was it. Glenn Gould playing Bach, right?
That's or Bach, yeah.
Is it Bach?
Bach.
You're not supposed to say German. Bach, right? It ain't B-A-C-K, it's
no,
B-A-C-H.
It's German pronunciation.
Do you have some more you want to talk about that? Or
We just got a call from a listener who asked me whether I publish mainly in computer science journals or in art history journals, and whether this is going to be a bona fide field, and sort of the interdisciplinary problems of a new field aborning.
About your work in the art,
in my
art
work
world.
In computer analysis of art. Mm-hmm. And most of my publications have been indeed in computer and image, technical image journals.
Oh, not in the art world.
Well, some in the art world. I've been invited to give plenary talks at bona fide art conferences, including the Renaissance Society of America, the American Institute of Conservators, and I'm giving a plenary talk at the annual conference on new directions in the humanities and so forth. So the humanists are awakening to this, but they don't have the technical expertise to evaluate the mathematics and the algorithms and so forth. So unfortunately, right now, there's no single good journal that has experts in the necessary experts in art history and in pattern recognition, computer vision. But I think that's changing. I think the conservators in particular are the first. They're used to technical analysis, mainly of paints and pigments and so forth. So science is not, foreign to them.
Well, you might be creating a new yeah. field in university study.
Yeah.
Because it might be in the art part of the university study, they might start using your technology, right?
Yeah. No, I think this is a new field aborning that you need expertise. I studied art history and computer vision and pattern recognition and image processing, and I think those are the fields you need in order to do serious work. If you haven't done all of those, really, you're liable to do really irrelevant work.
Do you know of anybody else that students coming up that are doing that?
Yes, there are a few students coming up nationwide. There was a recent PhD in basically this field from Princeton.
Hmm.
So it's just getting started, and that's what's very, very exciting.
It must be to be on the emerging, the cutting edge of a new emerging field.
Exactly.
Because one could think that everything's already been done.
Oh,
right?
Absolutely not. No. My God. The arguments against those, we know everything basically by now, is the sort of the intersection of different fields. If you take two fields that you think are disparate, do you really think they will never have anything to say to one another in the future? Well, that would be a tall order to fill.
For sure. David Stork is our guest, and David, you're blowing my mind with all this stuff here. What's coming up next in the music department?
Next comes music sung by the Anonymous Four. This is my favorite female vocal ensemble. They sang here at Stanford about 2 weeks ago in Memorial Church. This is from the Legends of St. Nicholas. These are the first two.
You mean the fat white guy with the reindeer? Are they talking about him?
I suppose so. I don't know all my biblical history or religious history, but these are the first two. So shall we just play them?
Let's do it.
Oh, no.
Wrong one?
Wrong one.
That's radio by hand.
Thank you.
Now, that's music to take a nap by for sure, man.
Don't say that.
Don't say that again. what do you call that? You call that like
medieval chant.
Okay, medieval chants. Okay, that's what it is. And that was like from way long ago when people are still living in castles, right?
Boy, you really are specific, aren't you?
Yeah,
way long
be.
Ago, people living in castles. Yes.
As the host, because they're in the radio, it's not TV, so you got to paint the picture for the people,
okay,
right?
Okay, fair enough.
Anyway, David Stork, this has been an amazing hour. I learned something every time a new professor comes in, and with you, it's just been too much. I couldn't even fit it all on one paper, from HAL 9000 to 8 different departments to 6 books. You got another book on the way out. You just changed the art world forever. Do you got enemies out there, too? Are there people that, like, no, I mean, they're like, they don't agree with your work?
There are controversies.
Do they show up to your gigs and like, hey, man?
100% of the time. People are happy with what I say.
Oh, that's good.
Every time
that's
I go, there, you know, the people who complain on print, you know, oh, what's this have to do with art and so forth. But I think those controversies are really behind us.
I get the feeling too that you haven't tried to use the technology to say something that isn't true. You've tried to let technology do the work itself.
That's what we do our best.
And you just use the technology to look at it and go, well, this is what the technology is telling us.
And I try to allay the concerns of the art community that says, oh, are we going to turn all of art into science? Are we going to take away interpretation? Are we going to take away? And absolutely not. This is a way to... The analogy
kind of
is like
back up their information,
it's like giving a microscope to a biologist. You expand their views. You expand the kinds of questions they can answer.
Give them some new tools.
New tools.
There you go.
And that's the deal.
Maybe that'll be the name of your next book. New
no,
tools.
It isn't. So we just have time for my last one.
Yeah. And that this is off the hook. You took another left turn on us. What's the deal?
This one's a right turn. Let's go.
Yeah. It's the Who, and you want to say anything about it?
No. Love ain't for keeping.
Is it the bottom one or the middle one?
Number 3.
Okay, got it. One. Hey, thanks for coming in. If people want to get a hold of you about anything, can they email you?
Artanalyst@gmail.com.
David Stork, thank you very much, and please come back sometime soon.
My great pleasure, Bert.
All right.